Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is getting on towards the one-year anniversary of the podcast. And one of the things that's been pretty consistent the entire year is true crime. And taking a little departure from old Hollywood to talk about something that has something to do with Hollywood, because one of the deaths happened in Hollywood. And once again, to join me on this crusade is Jen. Hey, Jen, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being patient, because once again, I was late.
Hey, look, we've been doing this a year. I'll always wait for you.
Yeah, you know, I just always late, and I can't remember the last time in the last month or so that I've actually been on time.
But we pull it off.
So, you know, so I appreciate that. And Jen always stays very flexible when it comes to, hey, can we make it 30 minutes later? Can we make it an hour later? And she's like, okay, sure. So I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome.
Taking a break kind of from Epstein and gossip, and it's nice to talk about something else. And we're going to talk about some of the Robert Durst murders. And I realize that there's been Netflix series and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that made me kind of want to talk about it is even I'm confused. I was confused. You know, you see his name in the headlines and you go, okay, yeah, some guy's crazy, dressed up like a woman to hide from the police, and he's rich. And, you know, I guess I didn't realize that there were so many murders associated with this guy and the possibility that there's dozens more.
He could possibly be a serial killer.
Yeah. You know, well, even if the what I think was Long Island ones or something, even if those aren't attributed to him, I think anybody who's killed as many people as he has, you got to almost consider him a serial killer.
Yes, because of the style that he goes on to display. A lot of the professionals, especially the medical examiner, starts talking about there's no way he could have came up with this after just one or two murders. You know, he must be seasoned. So that's kind of where they got their opinion from.
What is there? Let's say somebody just kills a whole bunch of people over the years, right? Does that make them a serial killer, or does there always have to be some kind of pattern?
Normally a pattern, and also there's a difference between spree killers and serial killers. Spree killers will just go through town or wherever. They'll shoot just for fun, kill just for fun. Serial killers are a little more methodical. They tend to use the same hunting or killing ground. They tend to use the same method over and over again instead of just shooting randomly in the woods or shooting randomly out of a car window and just hoping to strike a target. They'll actually hunt someone down. That tends to be their MO. So that kind of separates the two, spree killers, serial killers.
So when we talked in the past about, you know, some of those axe murders that happened at the turn of the century, you know, where somebody goes into a house and just butchers everybody, would we consider those a spree killer or a serial killer?
Definitely serial, because they're using the same weapon and they're planning it out. They're lying in wait on the family. The Canadian killers are spree killers because they shot randomly. You know, they walked up on someone that was in a camper, then they walked up on someone that was at basically a gas station, and then they set them on fire. Those are spree killers. They shoot whoever they come up on.
And, you know, it's fascinating to me. And it's, you know, somebody like this guy, you know, we'll talk about the murders and stuff, but just as I was, you know, looking through everything, do you think that, first of all, do you think we'll ever get a trial in this last one?
Well, they keep postponing it eventually. Yeah.
So it's up to January now. It was supposed to start tomorrow, which is, you know, one of the reasons that kind of piqued my interest, because it was supposed to start tomorrow, and it was continued a long time ago, but it was supposed to start tomorrow. And then I wonder, you know, he's just so old that even if they find him guilty, I mean, how much time is he realistically going to serve in a prison? So for these crimes. Why don't you go ahead and tell us just about some of the Robert Durst murders? Pick one, pick two, pick three, whatever you want to do.
All right, so this guy is Robert Durst. He's known as the Jinx due to that HBO miniseries that came out, and he's just a millionaire madman. He's the heir to a real estate fortune, and he cloaked himself in multiple identities. and he also cloaked himself in women's clothing. He was a cross-dresser, but he did it by design. And he also fooled around with the Jewish mafia, and he would deceive them. And he was very calculating, and that's how he began his spree of the suspected murders. He allegedly killed at least three people in different states, and that's just the ones that they know of. And the first one was the 1982 killing of his wife, Kathy. He had married her in 1970, and by 1982, he was already suspected of murdering her. She disappeared after going to a dinner party and never surfaced again. Did he contact police immediately? No. He waited 5 days. And after he cleaned out the house, he threw away all of her medical books because she was studying to be a pediatrician. And that was something that he was jealous of and got under his skin. So he threw out all of her stuff, just purged her from the home. And then he called the police, and that absolutely made him a suspect. No body, no crime back then. They had no evidentiary support, no reason to drag him in and physically charge him at the time. And so her death just went on as a cold case. And that was his first big crime.
Yeah, you know, and when you, I guess we'll just take him one at a time, but this is somebody that he seems to have had, when he is with a woman, he seems to move quickly and, you know, after two dates, he had invited her to move in, and, you know, he had opened a health food store, and then she moved in, and then they moved to New York, and they got married. And then, like you said, she went to medical school, and she was almost finished with medical school. And I think that that's what you said, where he was jealous of her, because, you know, while she's in school, it's just one thing. Oh, she's in school. She's in school. But at this point, she's getting close to ending school, and then she's probably going to do a residency, an internship, and, you know, she's going to be a doctor.
Yeah. And then he thinks about, oh, well, she could leave me, because in Vermont, he had had the health food store that he was excited about. And then her parents had encouraged them to move back to Manhattan in New York. And of course, the wife always wins. And they did move back. And I think he might have been spurned by that. And so when she went on to do the medical degree, he really didn't like that. So he would grab her by the hair and literally just carry her across the living room by her hair. He'd slap her around. There was many hospital visits in her records, a lot of domestic violence. So that household was not good.
And the night that she kind of, it's a little bit confusing. And I think that this is maybe part of the problem with the police is that, so she went out on the 31st, January 31st of 1982, and she went to a dinner party. And this person, it was at a friend named Gilberte Najami, and who later kind of turns up because it seems that Durst was stalking Najami later on in life. And then Najami kind of found it odd because McCormick kind of showed up. Kathleen showed up in red sweatpants or something like that, and she usually dressed nicer. And then she went home from that party to go see her husband. But then, I don't know, it seems kind of everything just kind of falls apart. She supposedly goes to see her husband, but he says that he put her on a train to New York, had a drink with a neighbor, then spoke to the wife by telephone. And it just, it's kind of interesting. I guess she went to his house, and then she was supposed to go back to a bar to go see Najami, right?
Yeah, that was his story. I don't think that she ever made it home after leaving the party. I think once she stepped out of the dinner party, she was either grabbed right then. And that's because as we go on to look at his motive in these other stories, how people go on to disappear. But he had a huge problem with not just pot. I mean, that's going to be the least nefarious thing he does. But he would binge on cocaine and then beat her up. So they had had a falling out or a fight maybe before she took off to the dinner party. And she may have had bruises that she was embarrassed about that might have explained why she wore what she did. And also she wasn't feeling very pretty. But she still wanted to not disappoint her friends and attend. So she dressed down and she went, but was he lying in wait outside?
I think you're right, because for her to go back to South Salem and then go back to Manhattan, because there was the doorman at one of the two Manhattan apartments, because we all just can't have one Manhattan apartment. We have to have two.
Of course.
He says that he saw McCormick there on February 1st. However, he said, well, you know, it was from behind. I couldn't really be sure. But to me, if she's wearing red sweatpants, it's going to be pretty obvious. But then a private investigator hired by Durst's own criminal lawyer said that the doorman said that he had not seen McCormick arrive at all. Do we think maybe the doorman was paid off?
Yes. I think that since this guy had a lot of money, he threw it around. And we also see that in this narrative. So he probably paid the doorman to cover for him. Maybe in the end, the doorman just couldn't do it. I don't know what type of closed, you know, circuit TV they had back then, any type of surveillance, but maybe he was concerned that his story would have holes in it and he didn't want to lose his job. But this guy, Durst, I mean, he could not be trusted. He was already beating her up, and she had told her friend a couple of days before she disappeared, if anything happens to me, he did it. And she called him Bob. She's like, you know, don't let Bob get by with this. And then, yeah, you know, she's gone after that.
And what this is, when you have the doorman give a statement to the police saying, you know, I might have seen her, I might not have seen her. And then if you have Durst with some kind of alibi, and then, you know, it's rich people and the police, you know, they want to be 100% sure before they go after the rich people. You know, it kind of muddies the waters, and then he makes them more muddy by having the doorman kind of change his story later and say, well, no, then I didn't see her. And it's just the more muddy the water, then the harder it is to ever kind of find a reason to charge the guy, especially you don't have a body.
And perhaps that's why he did it. Also, the more characters that you involve, like you said, the more puzzling it gets, and then it's hard to decipher anything. That is also a rich person's game. They'll hire a lot of attorneys, you know, and have them all talking at once to the opposing party, to the prosecution, just confuse them. Or they'll hire up a bunch of actors to give mixed alibis, and just the whole thing can be puzzling.
So they have two Manhattan apartments. They have this place in South Salem. Apparently she has a cottage. And then he also was paying for the apartment for a woman that he was dating at the time, unnamed Prudence Farrow, which by God is the best name for somebody in a murder mystery. Prudence Farrow.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just that you can't write a name better than that for something like this. So they had talked about getting a divorce, and you know, this is one of my things is, and this goes back to any case, is, you know, thinking about, say, you know, the Colorado one, and I forget the guy's name, and I know you know.
Patrick Crazy.
You know, and so, you know, they could get divorced. Instead of the divorce, he kills the wife and the kids, you know?
Yeah, but the thing with Patrick Crazy is they were not even married. That guy could have just walked away, but he wanted the child.
You know, I don't understand how people think, hey, murder is the better option than divorce.
It's risk versus reward. They hope they come out on top, and if they don't, they spend life in prison. I think that's a huge gamble, but people do it every day.
Yeah, and especially, you know, there's kids involved, so then, you know, they lose one parent to death, and the other parent is in jail for the rest of time. I mean,
And they're orphans.
Yeah, I don't understand the thinking of the people. And so going back to Durst, you know, she had wanted $250,000, which for a guy who's worth kajillions, that's hardly anything. And instead, he canceled the wife's credit card, removed her name from a joint bank account, refused to pay for medical school. And I mean, for $250,000, you know, his life probably would have been completely different.
Yes, but he was messed up on cocaine and not thinking clearly to begin with. And also, she had angered him. And at some point, he said something to someone in his life that he didn't mean to kill her, that it just got too aggressive and just too overly heated. We don't know if we can trust that or not, because he does go on to be what appears to be a serial killer. But he did express some type of remorse. But he also goes on to hire up the mafia to be his fixer.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I found, at least in the disappearance of McCormick, was, so you had the 31st, and then you had the doorman maybe see her on February 1st. But there was the supervisor at the medical school who had called on February 4th, but had said that she, Kathleen, had called in sick on February 1st.
Yeah, that's the strange thing, is that you have an adult calling in to a medical school, and instead of getting the administrator or asking for a teacher, the dean gets the call. The person asks for the dean of the school. That is not something you normally do. You do not bother the dean ever unless it's serious. So this person, who I don't believe is Kathy, says, you know, I will be skipping medical school for up to 1 or 2 weeks. And then she just hangs up. Well, Kathy's family says, number one, she wouldn't have called the dean. And second of all, she wouldn't have missed medical school because, like you said, she was about to graduate.
I wonder if it was Prudence who called. But you see, if you call the dean, then nobody knows your voice. He's not going to know Kathleen's voice. But somebody at, you know, a professor or something like that would be much more likely to know Kathleen's voice. So, you know,
either he paid a school administrator to do it, or we have to look at the mafia princess. We do have Susan who enters the picture. She's a fixer. Did she call? She could have. She's somebody that thinks that she's somebody, and she would ask for Dean.
Now, you know, she died. She was killed or missing in 1982, right? And then
2000. Ooh.
You know,
that was a hit.
I'm just saying, like, you have this gap with Kathleen. From it doesn't appear that anything was ever done.
Oh, yeah, you mean like her death from 82 up until Susan. Oh, yeah, like what, 18? How many years is that?
Gosh. Like 18 years.
Yeah, 18 years.
Nothing's done. So it's just they decide that the New York State Police quietly reopened the investigation, you know, in 1999, and they went and searched his residence. I'm thinking that perhaps, you know, most of the crime stuff is gone 17 years later.
Well, absolutely, because the mob's involved. That stuff was taken away immediately. I think the reason they might have opened it is because after what goes on to happen to Susan, the police look into it and they start seeing the bank transactions, how she was getting $50,000 and, you know, then $25,000 deposited into accounts. It's not the best way to pay someone, not traceable. But they see that. And then also Susan has a very overbearing son. He's not giving up on this case for anyone. He pushes and pushes to get justice for her.
Yeah,
and in the end, he does.
Yeah, it's the death of Susan Berman that's still kind of at issue. All these years later, back in 1982, when Kathleen was missing, you know, Susan was around, and Durst had told the LAPD that, you know, he had faxed investigators a copy of her 1982 deposition regarding his missing wife. So she was involved. Way back then, she has been in his life forever.
Yeah, she was his best friend from golden school days all the way up through high school. And she went on to become a journalist and then was also heavily tied into the underground scene. She had a lot of connections, and he absolutely utilized this. So he calls her up, you know. He's like, hey, I killed my wife. There's the body, you know. I guess the body had to be at the house or, you know, somewhere where it needed to be carted off immediately. She shows up. She brings in two henchmen, and they allegedly carry the wife off.
It's amazing that he let her live for another 18 years after that.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if she said anything. Did they ask for any more money? Did someone in the group ask for more money? Or did he just get more paranoid as time went on? Because mental illness does enter the picture. And it can deteriorate your brain. So was he just kind of, you know, was the cheese sledding off the cracker? Could have been.
Because I think he was diagnosed with basically Asperger's syndrome.
And then the
schizophrenia. And the combination of drugs and everything that he's taking, whether it's pot or coke and everything else. I mean, it definitely could make you paranoid. So there was obviously a deposition taken back in 1982, but you know, nothing was done, and it's remarkable. And now when, you know, Kathleen's parents tried to do something, but then they died, and then one of their children tried to do something, but the statute of limitations is expired.
Yeah, and they tried to, you know, sue him for $100 million for wrongful death, but without a body, and it was such a clean crime scene due to who cleaned it up, They didn't have anything to go on. The evidentiary support's not there to haul him in. If they had hauled him in, they'd have no reason to hold him.
So then we move on to Susan Berman. And on Christmas Eve in the year 2000, she was killed, murdered, execution style, in her home in Benedict Canyon, California. To me, this doesn't... Durst, does he sound like the kind of guy who's going to do execution style?
If she is saying something that he does not like and he fears going to prison, yes. If you back an animal into a corner, yes, it is 2 seconds to animal. They will eat your face off. Yeah, he probably did shoot her in the back of the head because she was the type of person, Jewish mafia daughter of one of the second highest gangsters at that time. Okay, her father worked under Bugsy, and that's just, that's huge. Okay, so not anyone can just walk up on her, but Durst could have. So I could see him shooting her in the back of the head, and he does have a murder weapon that matches the ballistics. That's huge.
It is. And, you know, her body was discovered. I should say her body was discovered on Christmas Eve 2000. He was actually...
Really? He has a thing for holidays. Have you noticed? New Year's?
Yes. Yes.
Christmas? Wow.
But he was, I guess, in New York the night before her body was discovered. So I guess that was supposed to be his kind of, I don't know, alibi or something for it.
His flight records are shifty because I looked at him and he was a couple of places very quick. I mean, he crisscrossed, I mean, almost Epstein style. He was here, there, and everywhere just trying to establish some type of alibi. It still made him, in my opinion, good for this. There was definitely time for him to have pulled this off. And the fact that he crisscrossed so many times for no good reason, I'm totally looking at him.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting was that he had been in Northern California, I guess, a few days before the murder, or before the discovery of the body. And, you know, not to jump around at all, but in 1997, was it? Yeah, 1997, there was a 16 years old, Karen Mitchell from Eureka, California, which is in Northern California. And, you know, she was, you know, credit card records placed Durst in Eureka on the day that she vanished.
Yes, that will always bother me because he was there at the right time and the witness went on to give a sketch. And it's uncanny how much it looks like Durst.
Yeah, this girl had volunteered in a homeless shelter that Durst had frequented. And this is a guy who at this time is worth, you know, $50-60 million. And he's hanging around homeless shelters. And, you know, I think that he's looking for people to kill rather than just hanging around in a homeless shelter. But he had dressed in women's clothing, had visited the shoe store owned by Mitchell's aunt. And then she was last seen walking to work from her aunt's store and then possibly speaking to someone in a stopped car. So it just shows, okay, so he's got this Northern California history. Because there was also the Christian Motoroffery, who was seen in 1997 also in San Francisco, so Northern California, and, you know, roughly the same time almost as, you know, the day that Karen Mitchell was gone. So he has these ties to Northern California.
Yeah, he sounds like a predator to me, like he is someone that is actively hunting, and that's what makes him, in my opinion, a serial killer. He likes common grounds where he is familiar with things. He goes back to them over and over again, and he hunts his prey. And these girls go on to not be found. And even that 1971 Middlebury, Vermont, that Lynn Schultz, she goes missing from near his health food store. She was standing outside the store, and then she's never seen again.
And we're talking about Middlebury, Vermont, not a lot of homicides. Eureka, California, not a lot of homicides. And
no.
Vermont,
you get moose.
Yeah, to get this guy in the same place for that. You know, there's a book called The Deadly Secret, and there's a journalist named Matt Burbeck who he reported this first. I mean, he wrote a book in 2015, Deadly Secret, but in 2003 he talked about. So we're talking 2003. He first brought up the whole Mitchell connection, and it doesn't appear that anybody has. I mean, when I look at it, hasn't really investigated that much.
Because there's so many missing persons and so many people that are actively screaming, you know, from the DOE network or for the UID network. It's hard to pick and choose who you're going to genealogy and try to help and figure out where they go. And if you do find their bones, you know, that takes a lot of work to ID them. With her, I mean, I would love to figure it out. I can look and see if someone's working it, but I mean, everyone's worth a look.
You know, in Middlebury, Vermont, a lot of woods, a lot of, you know, empty spaces. Same with Northern California, lots of woods, lots of empty spaces, pretty easy to dig a hole and nobody will find, you know, that body forever.
Oh yeah. Normally up there, it's your, whatever herb is growing, your ginseng hunters, mushroom hunters, whatever, they eventually stumble over stuff. You know, they trip over a log and there's a skull. It's things like that. It's just happenstance that they find bodies.
So let's go back to, since we're on Susan.
Okay.
She, you know, but it just, the thing that piqued my interest was the fact that he had been in Northern California, flew from San Francisco. And so he's up in Northern California and doesn't appear to be a really good reason. You know, I haven't looked at all his real estate records. And honestly, that Deborah Lee Cheritan appears to, you know, have controlled his real estate empire for a long time. It doesn't appear that he owned any properties or anything in Northern California. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I'm looking at the records right now. No, he did not own any at that time.
So, you know, I think it's just, you know, one of his hunting grounds. And San Francisco's got a lot of people, teenagers and stuff, who come to that city. They come from neighboring communities. They're in homeless shelters. And you have this guy who...
I think he shopped outside of where he lived. And he preyed on those that were defenseless and, like you said, the homeless.
Yeah. And
they would be very... The defense would be low because they're always going to people needing help and also... I mean, they're probably hungry. They can't fight real hard. And he's a stalker. He probably tried to blend with them.
He did stalk. And, you know, we can talk about that, too. But one thing, it feels like sometimes he, I don't know, this to me is not self-serving at all. He said that in a 2005 deposition that Berman called him shortly before her death to say that the LAPD wanted to talk to her about McCormick's disappearance. But a study of case notes... It doubts whether the LAPD ever called, and then whether Westchester County District Attorney Jeanine Pirro, who's on Fox right now, had scheduled an interview with Berman at all. So he's saying, hey, he's basically saying, I had a motive to kill her by saying these things, but these things aren't even true.
Yeah, he's inventing, you know, his own storyline in his head, and that's where I kind of think that he's a little off kilter. Because he's already getting paranoid. He's inventing things in his head. And then what goes on to be found in either his house or hers, is somewhere in the story, is the letters that he had written out. Why would you write out letters and leave them in your home regarding what happened that would completely incriminate you? So he does a couple of stupid things.
Well, he does lots. I mean, you know, do you know why she was killed? No, I've got no idea. Instead, he says, well, because the LAPD was going to talk to her and the district attorney out in Westchester County was going to talk to her. And, you know, so it's just like, all right. And I'm not even sure why, because I don't know. It blows my mind, you know, that you're giving those kind of answers. It just, and like you said, the writing, the letters, and it's just, okay, you know, I really don't get where you're going with all of this.
Yeah, it's like he can't get out of his own way.
So, for some reason, in 2000, I mean, I guess he's going, you know, on the lam, but he had been tipped off to the reopened investigation to his wife's disappearance. You know, so he decides he's going to go into hiding, but, you know, his wife's disappearance, there hadn't been anything that anybody had found 18 years earlier. Nobody did a dang thing in the 18 years. So I'm not sure. I guess it's his paranoia, but he says, oh, I got to go hide. I got to run. And so he moves to Galveston, Texas in the year 2000, living in a boarding house and again posing as a woman.
Yeah. So he takes on this identity as not a man, but a woman. And not even a woman that knows him. He just steals a random identity from someone that he went to school with. And he's living that life. And what is so nefarious about it is that he has a target in mind when he goes to Galveston. And he ends up By design, getting this apartment, renting an apartment directly across from someone that he has decided that he wants to kill.
Yeah, you know, it just...
That is 100% lying in wait, calculated, unadulterated, cold-blooded hate. And he does it.
Yeah. And, you know, and while he's there, apparently he's got his neighbor. A neighbor, only one person who knew that he was not, you know, a woman. And it's his neighbor, Morris Black. And Morris Black is elderly, cranky, and soon to be dead because he decides he's going to confront Durst about what we don't really know.
It might have been about what happened to Susan because it happens just a year later, and we come to find out that this guy, this Morris Black and his brother were close to Susan. And they were both Marines. I don't think you mess with Marines. So I could see how this situation got hot real quick.
And so the story goes that Durst says that he and Black got into a fight and they were struggling for control of Durst's pistol after Black had grabbed it from a hiding place. You know, I don't know how Black knew where it was, but he grabs it from a hiding place. He's threatening Durst with it. And during the struggle, and this is pivotal, the pistol discharged, shooting Black in the face.
That is a lucky shot.
It is. So it's to me, it's interesting because ultimately the reason that, you know, Durst is acquitted of any kind of murder or anything like that, or not even charged, is because there's not,
They never
found the head.
Oh boy, yeah. So after he shoots him in the face, I'm gonna go with that, with a 22 caliber target pistol. And he uses a paring knife and a saw, no, two saws and an axe. Okay, so I mean, how many tools did he need? And he dismembers this guy's body, and he puts the body parts into bags. He puts one leg in one bag, the other leg in another bag, and he puts the rest of his parts in a separate bag, and then he dumps it into Galveston Bay.
Yeah, and they found all the other parts, right, except for the face?
Yeah, unfortunately, a father and son that were fishing, you know, they think they're going to have the fishing trip of a lifetime. On September 30th of 2001, the little boy points and says, "Body!" And, yeah, it's a body floating. Because everything in Galveston Bay, for some reason, doesn't sink. It floats.
You know, so he is arrested and released on $300,000 bail the next day. And they, I don't know if they knew what kind of money he had.
No, or else they had
maybe
no idea.
Yeah, they would have made the bail so much higher.
Yeah, they'd give him like a million like they did that new girl. But they thought he was a vagrant because of the way he was dressed and how he was acting. You know, when they went to confront him, basically what happened was they collected everything from the crime scene. And there were things in the crime scene that led back to this Morris Black's home. There was a receipt. So they went to his home, obtained a warrant, went all through it. And then inside of his home, they found copious amounts of blood, bloody clothing, and then driplets of blood that led across the way to the next apartment door. Whose apartment door was it? Well, they thought it was Little Miss Dorothy. And she's supposed to be an eccentric, little old, middle-aged woman, Dorothy Signer.
And it turns out to be Mr. Durst.
Yeah, it's Durst, and he's just dressed in drag. And he is like, no, no comprende, I don't speak. And then he goes on to be a mute. He will only write letters. And then he goes on to just not cooperate at all.
And so they didn't know, you know, who he was, really. And they said, okay, $300,000 bail. It's not like this guy's going to make it. And he makes it the next day.
Oh, you know? He skips out on them, and
right,
they're mad.
Yeah, because, you know, so he missed a court hearing on the 16th of October, which was basically a week later. And, you know, the bail jumping. And then he's caught about a month and a half later in Pennsylvania. And again, this is a guy who seems to just shoot himself in the foot because he's arrested for shoplifting, even though he had a ton of money in his pocket. Even he had $37,000 of cash in his car. You know, so he had plenty of money, but he's just, I'm going to just go ahead and shoplift it. And that's how he got caught.
Yeah. Again, more stupid move that he goes on to do. But they did luminol on the walls of the house where he killed the man originally, mm-hmm. the Morse Black guy, and it just lit up like Christmas. Like there was blood all over all the walls. So maybe he thought that he couldn't beat that charge, and that might have been why he ran.
Yeah.
He's rather disgusting the way he dismembers people.
Yeah, and you know, and he had directions. This is where it comes back to Najami's house. That's the one, the original one where Kathleen McCormick had been visiting Najami's house the night before Kathleen disappeared. And you know, how would you feel if you knew that Robert Durst had, you know, directions to your house? You know, and at the same time, while he's gone these 6 weeks, he also stalks his brother in New York while armed.
He was mad. Was that after the father died?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so you have the inheritance on the line. You have a father die, and then, you know, they're both heirs, him and the brother. And no one is really liking Robert Durst at the moment. So the younger child goes on to get the majority and to run the business.
And then I think Durst settled for $65 million. But he had his own. So, yes, he gets the $65 million in the inheritance. But he had other money that from a trust. I think he was getting a couple of million a year or whatever. And he was buying real estate. And that Deborah Lee was who he married for convenience, she has power of attorney, and she is buying and selling properties, and he's making a ton of money in addition to this $65 million while all of this other stuff is going on.
Oh, yeah, he wasn't hurting.
No.
Not by any means.
Not at all. And, you know, so they go to trial, and, you know, he admits to, you know, all those things and dismembering and bagging and dumping. But so because they don't have that, the face to show, okay, he did shoot him in the face or he didn't shoot him in the face, the jury acquits him of murder.
Yeah, we have no way to figure out bullets. Did he die from asphyxiation? Did he die from getting beaten in the head? I mean, the head's missing, so they have no choice but to believe him that, you know, self-defense, whatever, and then they just cut him loose and because there's no forensics.
And I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know if you're going to know the answer. But so when we go back to, say, 82, when Kathleen was killed and there was no body, you know, it was tough to make a case. And when Chris, I think it was Chris Peterson, right? Did they ever find his wife? I don't even remember now.
Scott Peterson with Lacey?
Scott Peterson. Yeah.
Yeah, they fished her out of the bay.
Okay, they did. But I mean, it's not that common where you, especially back in the 80s, where if you didn't have a body, then you would still try somebody for murder, would it?
It depends on if they had evidence in the house. This house was clean.
Okay.
They had no blood with her, no clothing, nothing. It was completely a spotless scene, which means they had a very good fixer. With the Morse Black guy, it was sloppy.
Yeah.
You know, blood on the wall, clothing everywhere. You could tell he had no help in that. So it just depends on the crime scene.
So if there's a disappearing body and nobody ever finds the body and there's not any signs of foul play, then chances are good, then you're going to beat the rap.
Yes, because in the Kelsey Barrett case, what saved them was teeth. They found just her teeth, molars at first in her townhome. That's how they got Patrick Frazee. From there, it was up to them to go through dumps and everything else to try to find anything else they could even match to her. And I still don't even know if they've done that, but you have to find something. A tooth, blood, piece of clothing, something that links back to their DNA to prove they're no longer here.
So then, in 2004, after he's acquitted of the murder, he ends up pleading guilty to two counts of bail jumping and one count of evidence tampering, which was a fancy thing for saying, hey, for cutting up the body, we're going to call it evidence tampering.
Yeah, how nice of them to smooth that over.
Yeah, you know, and actually, I haven't looked at the sentencing guidelines, but, I mean, he got 5 years for that, which seems, I mean, for bail jumping and evidence tampering, obviously it's a different kind of evidence tampering than one would normally. 5 years seems kind of stiff maybe, but, you know, he gets credit for time served. So he just has to serve 3 years in prison. And
they could have charged him with desecration of a body.
Oh, that would have been a good one.
Yeah.
That would have been a good one. Because so what happens is he's sentenced to 3 more years that he hasn't served. But the thing is, with the parole rules and everything, he gets out in 2005.
Kind of. He messes up again.
But I mean, and he messes up this guy. Like you said, you know, the Jinx is a perfect kind of name for that series, because he's supposed to stay at home. And instead he goes, you know, I'm going to go to the boarding house where Morris had been killed. And he goes to a shopping mall, and at the mall, he runs into the judge who presided over his trial.
Literally. He runs into the Honorable Susan Crist, and she's just like, what are you doing here? Because in her mind, she's thinking, you are the last person that needs to be around the public, at a mall, or anywhere else.
And I wonder if she thought that he was there to kill her, like he'd been following her.
Probably. After her statement in 2015, kind of seems like it. I felt bad for her, but yeah, she goes on to get Texas Board of Paroles to slap him right back into his prison cell.
So anyway, so it's December, but he's not in there for very long, because this is December 2005, where he runs into her at the mall, and they send him back to jail, but he gets out on March 1st, 2006, so he's only in there for 3 months.
It's probably greasing some palms. I mean, this guy's loaded.
You know, it's just... I think you're right. I think that you're right. I think that, you know, when you have that kind of money and you can just throw it all around, 3 months doesn't seem
because we've
like a
seen
lot.
It. We
he
just
could
saw
have gone
this,
back to jail for 2 more years.
We just saw this at MCC. There's money free flowing. We've read the stories. They grease palms to get whatever they want. Back then, they could get by with a lot more, and they could probably buy themselves out quicker than they can today. That's what he did.
And like you said, Chris, in 2015, you know, what she said is kind of scary. She said, you could see that this person knew what they were doing and that it was not a first time. The body was cut perfectly like a surgeon who knew how to use this tool on this bone and a certain kind of tool on that muscle. It looked like not a first time job. That was pretty scary.
Yeah. So think of the Black Dahlia, how they described it like that. Just surgically precision cuts, and there's no way this guy could be a novice. I mean, he didn't have any type of medical background, not that I'm aware of. So where did he learn this?
Yeah, by killing a bunch of people and chopping them up.
By practicing.
So, you know, he kind of, you know, you've got all this thing going on in the background where you have the McCormick thing and you have the Berman thing. But it's, you know, he does get arrested in Louisiana. Because he's a felon he's carrying a weapon and controlled substance and things like that. And this kind of all is a kind of a precursor to getting him back to California for the Berman thing. But it's because of the series that he agreed to, that his wife had told him, why do not agree to do this series.
Yeah, that's never a good idea. So he gets picked up by the FBI, and, you know, all the state line stuff comes in because all these murders are in different states. And then you have prosecutors that are working together to try to package it, you know, bundle it up and make all these intertwine. And that's where he gets messed up.
Yeah. And, you know, and this is also where the whole Louisiana thing is where you're finally seeing, okay, he's not in good shape. You know, he's got hydrocephalus, had a stent put into his skull. He's had spinal surgery. He's had cancer removed from his esophagus. You know, he does not seem like a very healthy guy at all. And I wonder, it's going to be if he dies before any of this happens. But even if there's a trial, who knows what he'll say? And, you know, it's just.
I don't even know if they can even. I mean, he's probably he has diminished capacities at this point, because he was already diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, and then he had schizophrenia, you know, from a child up. All of that is going to play into, or at least I'm sure his defense is going to try to get that to play into what is said in court.
So what you had is in 2015, you had the Jinx, and so some judge says, you know, let's do a warrant. And so there was a warrant signed by a judge. And in 2015, Durst was arrested in New Orleans, where he had registered under the false name Everett Ward. And he was observed wandering aimlessly in the lobby, mumbling to himself. They find marijuana, they found guns, they found birth certificate, passports, maps of Louisiana, Florida, Cuba, a fake Texas ID. He's got 42 grand in cash. There was a tracking number, which led to another 117 grand in cash. And he had been taking out money. He took out 315 grand in a little bit more than a month. This guy is flush with cash.
Yeah, that, but the passports and the fake IDs, that's what does you in. That's what will always get you no bail and get you in the most trouble.
Yeah, and, you know, but he could have been gone a long time before this.
They all could. I never understand. It's the mental thing. Why do they come home if they have the means not to? And why does this guy continue to play with the system? Because he always loses. He always ends up in jail somehow. And then this time he really messes up.
I mean, he could have been in Cuba for the 10 years prior to this.
Yes.
You know, instead, he's got the with the maps of Cuba and everything, but he could have been gone 10 years earlier and he wouldn't have ever been, you know, extradited probably from Cuba because he could have really made his money go a long way there throwing it out. And, you know, just
sometimes they won't leave what they know.
Yeah. So you had him getting arrested and, you know, this is where his ego in agreeing to participate also with the Jinx thing also brings him down. And, you know, just because he was excited that somebody had, you know, made a movie kind of about him or something. And he's like, oh, wow, I love this. I love when people are talking about me. And then, you know, says, let's do this, you know, the Jinx thing or whatever. And I don't know.
Just the last thing you want to do if you have an open investigation or anything that could possibly be opened is, yeah, sure, go start talking to people and let them record it.
So anyway, he gets arrested in 2015. The soonest his trial will occur is January 2020, almost 5 years after he was arrested.
Yeah, because they're going to try to tie in all this stuff. They're talking about, you know, connecting all the deaths and a domino effect. That could be really bad for him. And also trying to bring in the gun. That's the first time they've mentioned in any of these trials really about the gun besides him shooting the guy in the face.
Yeah. I mean, he's been off the streets, obviously, which is helpful for the last 5 years because gosh, only knows how many other people would have died. But it seems like, you know, a long time and the longer it goes, you know, they said that there was some problems with the older witnesses with Berman because, I mean, it did happen almost 20 years ago. So, you know, they've taken their testimony and stuff, which I guess they'll use in trial, in case they do die. But it seems like we're going to miss out on a lot of stuff just because they're taking so long with this. This is what I wish they would do. I wish they would cut him a deal where, you know, he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail, which is probably not going to be that long, but can we get some guilty pleas on some others just so we get the records cleared?
I would love that. I think what the hangup is that since the attorneys are citing that there is concern about the volume of evidence, does that mean that the HBO series brought in a lot more evidence because they're the ones that went on to discover the letters and then, you know, the other stuff in the envelopes and then other things that they have not discussed yet? They brought in a forensic scientist to analyze it to make sure it was his writing and it was certified that it was. So all of that evidence could be the hang up.
Well, also, let's not forget that lawyers get paid by the hour.
Absolutely.
If there's a guilty plea right now, they are going to be, you know, minus all the money that they're going to charge between now and the start of whatever trial in 2020, plus all of that, plus any kind of appeals and stuff. But I mean, because he is near, it looks like he's near death. I really would like to, you know, I'm sure that the families of Lynn Schultz or Karen Mitchell or Chris Madoffrey. I mean, I'm sure they'd like some kind of closure and they're not going to get it unless, you know, you get some kind of plea deal where he says, okay, this is what happened. And just, you know, I don't understand what's really in it for him. Does he think, okay, I'm going to beat this charge? And let's say he does beat the charge. So then you know what they'll do next? If he beats the Berman charge, they'll arrest him on the McCormick charge just to do it.
Oh, yeah, they're going to keep tying him up, trying to get answers, like you said, on those other girls. So he might as well go ahead and tell them. If they give him a plea deal, there's nothing more that he can lose.
The one of the things where, you know, they talked about the Long Island serial murders, and the FBI really couldn't connect him. And, you know, they were just going by how the victims were disposed the same way as the black. To me, just because you're disposed that way doesn't necessarily mean you're the person.
Well, Lisk used the burlap, and, you know, he liked a beach for the most part. And he liked prostitutes. So that's going to be definitely a serial killer. Has a pattern, hunting ground. Tend to think that person might have been in some type of environmental, the original Lisk, at least, environmental beach surf control, because those burlap sacks are the kind that you fill with sand. And they were also neutral colored, so they'd match the sand on the beach. The person really thought it through. I think that's an educated person. Robert Durst is dumb as a brick. He's just an opportunist.
Yeah. You know, and I would like to know this also. This private investigator found out that Durst had identities from Texas, Florida, Massachusetts, New Jersey, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Virginia. You know, where did he get those? You know, I think it would be...
We need to research it.
Yeah.
Maybe the homeless shelter? Is that why he went?
Oh,
was it easy to lift IDs?
Oh, there you go. Sure. That's actually a really good point. And, you know, but if he's in these homeless shelters, then maybe we need to go back to all of these states. It would be nice to track where he was, especially maybe from 2005 to 2015, and to see if there's any killings along in the wake.
Yes.
And I feel...
A pin map and that .22 pistol. See if anyone was killed with .22s.
Yeah, and I feel like we're just missing out because we're just dragging on the Berman thing. And obviously I want that to be settled, but we're only focusing on the Berman when there could be so many, many more, and we have a limited amount of time where this guy's going to be alive.
Yes, and that's where we need law enforcement to step forward and tell us how some of these victims were killed, because they hold that evidence back to the vest. They won't tell you how, especially children, are killed. They hold it. So we wouldn't know if it was .22s or if it was strangulation. If they would tell that, then we could possibly connect more things.
Yeah. All right. Well, that, you know, something that takes a week, you and I, we managed to do in under an hour. So
that's what we do.
I know. Well, I appreciate you, and I appreciate you sticking around for a year, and we will be back next week, I think. I'm going to function into doing this old Hollywood case. So we'll be back around next week. Thank you.
We sure will. Bye, everyone.
Bye.